From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The 1946 Harold Arlen Johnny Mercer musical St. Louis Woman bombed when it first opened on Broadway, but it produced songs that endured, like Come Rain or Come Shine and Any Place I Hang My Hat Is Home. On today's Fresh Air, we discuss the current revival of St. Louis Woman with Larry Maslin, who rewrote the libretto for the show, and with the show's star, Vernell Bonnaries. St. Louis Woman is on stage at the Prince Music Theater in Philadelphia. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new CDs by Britney Spears and Hanson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Members of the OPEC oil cartel have agreed to raise their official crude oil production by 3%. Oil ministers from the cartel told reporters that a production increase of more than 700,000 barrels a day will take effect next month. A bigger supply of crude oil should help stabilize or even reduce oil prices, but prices continued to rise on world markets today. Analysts said the increased production is unlikely to have much impact on U.S. gasoline prices this summer. They said the actual increase in oil will probably be much smaller than it appears, because many OPEC members are already exceeding their quotas by a total of about 500,000 barrels a day. A big donor to President Clinton's re-election effort 4 years ago is pleading guilty in the Justice Department's probe of the 1996 presidential campaign. Lobbyist Pauline Kancianalak was a guest at one of the controversial White House coffees. NPR's Peter Overby has details.
The White House and the Democratic National Committee insisted the coffees were not actual fundraising events. But in today's plea agreement, Kancianalak admits that she made or arranged contributions totaling $457,000 in connection with the coffee held 4 years ago this week. President Clinton was at the coffee, so was John Wong, the DNC official whose fundraising practices led to this investigation and others. The Justice Department's Campaign Financing Task Force has won 9 other convictions against individuals and corporations that gave or raised money for the 96 Clinton-Gore effort. The task force also investigated some Republican fundraising. But aside from John Wong, no officials of either party have faced charges. Peter Overby, NPR News, Washington.
Pentagon officials say they're running short of anthrax vaccine and may be forced to suspend the military's inoculation program. Quinn Kleinfelder reports from member station WDET in Detroit.
The Michigan-based laboratory, which is the nation's only supplier of anthrax vaccine, shut down production of the drug in early 1998. The Food and Drug Administration forced the move after it cited numerous quality control violations in the vaccine's production. Now, the military says it has fewer than 200,000 doses of the anthrax vaccine remaining. At the current rate of inoculation, the military will run out of the vaccine by the end of the summer. Pentagon officials had already scaled back plans to inoculate all 2.5 million active and reserve personnel, instead giving the vaccine primarily to troops traveling to Korea and the Middle East. Pentagon officials are considering suspending the program entirely to maintain a reserve supply of vaccine in the event of war. A final decision should be made within the next few weeks. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 63 points to close at 10,498 in moderate trading. This is NPR News. President Clinton has awarded the Medal of Honor to 22 Asian American veterans of the Second World War. Only 7 of the men honored were alive to receive the nation's highest decoration for valor. The other 15 medals were presented to family members of the honorees. The wife of an American businessman jailed in Russia on spying charges is pleading for her husband's release. She visited him in a Moscow prison yesterday. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports.
An emotional Cheryl Pope says her husband, Edmund, looked weary when they met yesterday in Moscow's Lefortovo prison. She says he's cold and hungry and has lost weight since his April 3rd arrest.
And we embraced, and the first thing he said to me is, "I'm innocent." And I said, "I know you are."
Edmund Pope runs Surf Technologies International, a consulting firm based in State College, Pennsylvania. Russia's Federal Security Service accuses him of stealing military secrets. He was reportedly gathering information about a Russian torpedo. Two Pennsylvania congressmen, John Peterson and Kurt Weldon, though, have urged Moscow to free Edmund Pope, arguing he was not a spy, but a businessman who bought technology that was openly advertised by Russia. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Moscow.
Federal authorities have charged five police officers from Orange, New Jersey, with violating the civil rights of a man they mistakenly believed had killed a policewoman. The five officers are accused of killing Earl Faison, kicking him, beating him, and spraying him with pepper spray while he was handcuffed. Faison was falsely suspected of murdering Orange police officer Joyce Carnegie last year. Another man later confessed to the killing. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Two great songwriters, composer Harold Arlen and lyricist Johnny Mercer, collaborated on the songs for the 1946 musical St. Louis Woman. It had a great score, including Come Rain or Come Shine, Any Place I Hang My Hat Is Home, and I Had Myself a True Love. The show had an all-African-American cast with terrific stars, including the song and dance team of the Nicholas Brothers and Pearl Bailey. But the show flopped, and that was blamed not on the music or the cast, but on the book. A couple of years ago, the Encore series in New York mounted a revival. Now the Prince Music Theater in Philadelphia is reviving the show, but they commissioned a new book, adapted from the musical and from the novel it was based on. The basics of the story remain. It's about a jockey named Lil Augie, who has always been blessed with good luck, so good that he effortlessly wins a beautiful woman away from her tough guy boyfriend. But when the ex-boyfriend is shot and believes that Augie killed him, he puts a curse on Augie, which may reverse Augie's luck forever. In a moment, we'll meet the writer Lawrence Maslin, the former associate director at Arena Stage in Washington, D.C. First, let's hear Harold Nicholas from the original 1946 cast recording of St. Louis Woman.
You're gonna love me like nobody's loved me. Come rain or come shine. Happy together, unhappy together, and won't it be fine? Days may be cloudy or sunny, we're in or we're out of the money, but I'm with you, Della. I'm with you, rain or shine.
That's music from the original cast recording of St. Louis Woman. Lawrence Maslin, welcome to Fresh Air. The music theater world seems to pretty much be in agreement that the music from St. Louis Woman is terrific and that the book stinks. Now, you're not doing the original book. You rewrote the book for this Prince Music Theater production. What is so awful about the original book?
The original book was based on a novel called Godsend Sunday by a major light of the Harlem Renaissance named Arne Bontemps. And it was this very picaresque, sad novel called Godsend Sunday about a black jockey who had good luck and bad luck and traveled the country and it wasn't your typical fare by any means. And then in the middle of the Federal Theater Project in New York, the Federal Theater Project had a unit called the Negro Theater Unit. Audiences may be familiar with that through the film Cradle Will Rock. And they did a very brief run of a play version of this novel called St. Louis Woman that Arne Bontemps collaborated with County Cullen, another major poet from the Harlem Renaissance, had a very brief run. And then after the war, there was a kind of upsurge, I guess, in the idea of doing some black musicals. Stormy Weather and Cabin in the Sky were very popular film musicals during the war. And this material was optioned by a Broadway producer named Edward Groves. And I think it was sort of a kind of a shotgun marriage in a way, because Colin and Bontemps were asked to provide the libretto, and they worked with Arlen and Mercer, and things kind of went from bad to worse. Not among these gentlemen, but poor County Colin died 2 days before it went into rehearsal. And I think more than anything, the original material, which is salty and contradictory and difficult and idiosyncratic and wonderful, got ironed out by a lot of the conventions of post-World War II musicals.
How did it get ironed out? What were the conventions, and what just doesn't work about the book? Why is it so bad that no one wants to touch it?
I think there are a number of things. I think it has its own flavor, or its own wrinkles, as I like to say, and I think those wrinkles were steamed out. I mean, back then you had Laurie and Curly in Oklahoma, and then you had the comic subcouple, Ado Annie and Will Parker, and then you had to have your dream ballet, and of course, you had to have a happy ending,
mm-hmm.
or you couldn't have a musical. And I feel all those pressures were sort of put onto the show, whether they were conscious or not. The story, which by its nature, I think is almost Shakespearean, because it's a man dealing with his luck, with his fate, being a jockey, and wrestling with concepts of that, is tough to make happy. And I think in the original book, the way in which it's made happy is very unconvincing. And by its nature, the story is 1898 St. Louis, gamblers, fast women, all sorts of role projections that had to be toned down. And I totally respect that, but I think in toning it down, they also took a lot of the verve that was in the original out of the show as well. So by an odd contradiction, some of the portrayals are probably more offensive in the 1946 version than in the original 1931 novel.
Give me an example of something that you as a contemporary reader find offensive in the original 1946 book for the musical.
I think everyone is so happy. I know that shouldn't be necessarily offensive, but everyone has a kind of, golly, everything's going to work out okay if we just tap dance in Act Two. And that's fine. It's a musical convention that is obviously happening across the street with white musicals, but somehow there's a kind of, I think from a contemporary perspective, 2000 perspective, that we know that to be black in St. Louis in 1898 was a far more complicated issue than is portrayed in the 1946 version. It's all very musical comedy.
So we get into this kind of funny situation where the original book for this musical, which was written by two highly esteemed African-American writers from the Harlem Renaissance era, is being rewritten by a white writer because people today find the original book too stereotyped and kind of offensive. It's kind of bizarre in its own way.
It's frightening. I mean, I must say, walking into that first day of rehearsal and being confronted by this extraordinarily talented local company of African-Americans,
mm-hmm.
and having reconstructed dialogue and written my own dialogue and trying to assume the idiom of the original, that was really frightening. I really was concerned that I have the integrity to do it. And then something occurred to me in that dark night of the soul that only writers writing librettos know at 4 a.m. that structure has no color, at least in my opinion, and that what the show really needed was structure. It really needed to be put back into a certain kind of order that would make some sense. And I went back to the novel and the play, and thank God I found the manuscript of the play, the 36 play, at the Schomburg Center up in Harlem's New York Public Library Center. And that was it. I mean, that was the roadmap. And I took lines from other characters. Whenever I could, I tried to put words that these two gentlemen wrote on the page, even if they were from page 97 of the novel from a completely different context, or even if it was a narration that I somehow turned into dialogue. I thought that as long as I kept that as my compass, I was comfortable trying to create some kind of contemporary integrity for the piece.
Why don't we hear another song from the original cast recording of St. Louis Woman? And I thought we'd hear Harold Nicholas of the great song and dance team, the Nicholas Brothers, singing Riding on the Moon, which is a wonderful rhythm song. And Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about how this is used in the original production and how you've placed it in a slightly different context for your book.
Well, we've taken all the fun out of it in our book. not exactly. But Riding on the Moon was a
solo. It.
But it's so much more poignant and interesting now. Now you'll laugh and you'll cry. What could you ask for more? You could ask for anything more, as Irving Berlin would say. Harold Nicholas plays Little Augie, who's this pint-sized butt of lightning who comes into St. Louis and is this great jockey. And he's been cursed by a man who thinks Little Augie has shot him. And he's sort of nervous about his luck going into the Swanee Handicap, which is the big race. But his girlfriend tells him that she loves him anyway. And, of course, he's riding on the moon. And in the original version, that's sort of the penultimate number, and he wins, and everything is all swell. In our version, he has been cursed by this guy, and he still sort of can't get out from under it. And Riding in the Moon happens a little earlier, and with a lot of bravado, he goes to the racetrack and runs the big race. And what happens in our production at the big race, I will leave up to the paying customers to find out.
Well, okay. This is Harold Nicholas singing Riding on the Moon.
High luck or low luck or no luck at all, I'll never care if I rise or I fall. I've learned a lesson since we've been apart. I'll do all right if I follow my heart. I walk on the ladders, number 13 doesn't scare me, 'cause I'm dressed up in a rainbow and I'm riding on the moon. Had me cornered, but I found out how to shake it, and my true love helped me break it. Now I'm riding on the moon. Oh, yes, you can preach it, sister, while I shout for joy. Oh, yes, say hello to Lady Love's baby boy. You're my ring of rose, I can't be heavy-hearted, 'cause I'm right back where I started, and I'm riding on the moon.
Harold Nicholas from the 1946 original cast recording of St. Louis Woman. We heard from Lawrence Maslin, who wrote the new adaptation of St. Louis Woman, commissioned by the Prince Music Theater in Philadelphia. It runs through June 25th at the Prince. Coming up, we meet the star of the revival of St. Louis Woman, Vernell Bonnerice. This is Fresh Air. Vernell Bonnerice stars in the new Prince Music Theater revival of St. Louis Woman as the jockey Lil Augie. He also wrote, directed, and starred in the hit show One More Time and its sequel Furthermore and the musical fable Stagger Lee. He won an Obie Award and an Outer Critics Circle Award for his portrayal of Jelly Roll Morton in his show Jelly Roll. Bonnerice has appeared in the films Down by Law and Pennies from Heaven, and he performed on two of the programs in Fresh Air's American Popular Song series. I want you to hear his singing before we talk. Since there isn't a cast recording of the new revival of St. Louis Woman, let's hear him singing at the Sacramento Jazz Festival as recorded last month for a forthcoming edition of the public radio jazz series Riverwalk Live from the Landing. Here's Vernell Bonnerice singing I'm Confessin' with pianist John Sheridan and the Jim Cullum Jazz Band.
How I long to tell you that I love you. Love finds a way so poets say. Every dream I dream is only of you. Come cuddle near and listen, dear. I'm confessing that I love you. Tell me, do you love me too? I'm confessing that I need you. Honest, I do. Need you every moment. In your eyes I read such strange things, but your lips deny they're true. Will your answer really change things, making me blue? I'm afraid someday you'll leave me, saying, can't we still be friends? If you go, you know you grieve me. All my life on you depends. Am I guessing that you love me? Dreaming dreams of you in vain. I'm confessing that I love you over again.
Brunell, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Because you've, in your own shows, in the shows that you've written and produced, you've really specialized in early jazz and the vaudeville era.
Yeah.
And because some of those songs come out of, you know, like the blackface era, you've had to wrestle with a lot of issues pertaining to how to sing old songs in a contemporary setting.
Yes.
And not to feel like you're either offending the audience or offending yourself.
Yeah, definitely.
In what you're performing. Now, the book for St. Louis Woman was rewritten.
Yes.
In part, I think, because it was considered a little offensive in having this, like, happy-go-lucky cast.
Well, it was very offensive in a lot of cases, particularly when you have things like the idea that a woman, in order for a man, in order to believe that a man loves her, he has to beat her. And that was stripped away.
Huh.
There were lots of moments in it that just, we've grown way past any of that as a group.
St. Louis Woman has an all African American cast.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like for African American actors when a casting call goes out for a musical that has a lot of parts for black performers in it, which is unusual?
It's a celebration and a job opportunity. Unfortunately, just 15 years ago, we had an enormous amount of material that actors and actresses could put themselves into, with UB and Amos Behaving and One More Time and so many different pieces, but The Wiz. That really, I mean, if you look at what is presented today on Broadway, there are no black shows. And so to resurrect some feasible material, I think, is really necessary.
It must be hard for you as an African-American performer to do the work that you want to do when there's so few parts for black performers. I'm wondering if you feel that through much of your career, the roles you've gotten or the roles that you haven't gotten have been affected by your color.
Oh, without a doubt, yeah. And that's across the board.
Mm-hmm.
Not only have I been prejudiced against on the African-American level, but even, for example, in August Wilson play, when you're casting a family because of being a light-skinned African-American, in my case, I can't get the job there. So I'm sort of stuck on both sides.
You're considered too light for certain black roles?
Yeah, definitely.
Are you told that?
Yeah. Blatantly, I would say.
What do you respond to? What do you say in response?
You just don't do the right. audition. You just, well, thank you. And
you don't even get to the audition.
I get in, and mm-hmm. they say, well, you know, we really couldn't use you because you're not going to fit with the family, or you're not going to be blah, 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 blah. And so I thank you. Well, you can read anyway if you like. No, I really don't care. Thank you.
Is this part of what's led you to do so many productions of your own, where you're the writer, you're the lead performer, you do some of the producing for it, the directing? I mean, so you decide what your musical values are going to be, what show you want to do, what era you're interested in, and you don't have to worry about somebody else deciding whether you're right for it or not.
Yeah. Basically, I'm driven by necessity. As a performer, as a writer, as a director, I find the material and I think of the material myself, and then I go for it because I really can't depend on casting directors at this point.
Well, you have had a role recently on Broadway in Cy Coleman's musical, The mm-hmm. Life, and I thought we could play your song from that show. But before we do, tell us a little bit about your role in the show.
Well, the role was that of the bartender. It was about hookers in the 70s on Times Square, and I was the bartender where they all went for a sort of respite. But once a year, I would give this big ball. I was the MC of the ball, and the number was used to close up the first act before intermission. So it had to just come out and kick right from the top.
And was this part written, an ethnic definition for the character? Was the character written as white or African-American, or was it open?
No, I think it was pretty open. Originally on the CD, however, Bobby Short did the backers CD.
Oh.
And so they wanted somebody that could kind of go with that nostalgic sort of feeling that Bobby has.
This is Vernell Bonnery's from the original cast recording of The Life, music by Cy Coleman.
Everybody save your bunks. Everybody rent your tux. Everybody dress deluxe. We're going to the hooker's ball. Invitations in the mail. Get your baby out of jail. Go ahead, make her bail. You're going to the hooker's ball. We're gonna eat and drink and be merry. We're gonna dance all over the floor. After party, gonna party like you never partied before. Dress yourself as bold as brass. Give yourself a touch of class. Hurry up and move your ass. We're going to the hooker's ball. To New York and San Francisco, they all come from far and near to attend this celebration that is held one night a year. Only those...
Vernell Bonnery's is now starring in the Prince Music Theater revival of the musical St. Louis Woman. It runs through June 25th in Philadelphia. Bonnery's will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the Internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide. At www.alcatel.com. And from Random House, Inc., Harmony Books Division, publishers of Transistor Radio, a novel by Chris Bojalian, author of Midwives and The Law of Similars. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Vernell Bonnery's, who is currently starring in the revival of St. Louis Woman, and Ken Tucker reviews new CDs by Britney Spears and Hanson.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Vernell Bonnaries, the star of the new revival of the Harold Arlen Johnny Mercer musical St. Louis Woman, produced by the Prince Music Theater in Philadelphia. Bonnaries also wrote, directed, and starred in several music revues, including One More Time, Staggerly, and Jelly Roll. Now, Vernell, your own productions have focused on early jazz and vaudeville, music from the earlier part of the 20th century. Why do you gravitate to that era? Is it music that you heard a lot when you were growing up, or something you developed a taste for later?
Well, I think that it's sort of the richest soup. That it's where everything sort of grew from, the fertile soil. And for me, I just find a great respect for the composers, for the performers at that time. I mean, they were really breaking ground, and it was an exciting moment. And people always refer to the Harlem Renaissance in the 20s and know about the literature of it. But there was a Renaissance period at that point, because there was so much defiance and self-respect being built, and pride. And I can feel all of that in the music. And the music was a popular music of that time. So they were really in the swing. It wasn't about nostalgia or whatever. And I think also coming from New Orleans, which is the hotbed of jazz and the birthplace, you just go to the real source.
What did you hear growing up in New Orleans?
Oh, I heard... From a child, I heard the real bottom line traditional New Orleans music, the brass bands in the streets for funerals, and then we had the party bands for christenings and birthday parties, and people who are now thought of as the legendary founders of the music were people who were playing at that time. And they were older men at that point when I was a kid, but they were still there.
I've never been any place where there's been like a funeral brass band.
Uh-huh.
So to me, you know, when there's a funeral, it's a hearse and a lot of cars going by with their lights on, and it's a really somber occasion. And when you see the funeral procession going by, you just kind of stop and get this chill for a mm-hmm. few seconds, even when you don't know the people at all. Mm-hmm. What's it like for you growing up when a brass band would march by playing this great music because there was a funeral?
Well, you realize that it's a celebration of the release of the person from the miseries that life can present if you're African-American living in a segregated southern city. And so it's a party. They've graduated, and they're brought to all the places that they help to make a happy spot. Corner bars and different friends' houses. They're passed in front of it, and sort of a last goodbye and a congratulations that you graduated. I have a book, by the way. I did the text on a photo book from the early jazz funerals. Well, they're actually from the 60s, that Leo Touche, a photographer, took these wonderful pictures, and I did the text on the book. It's called Rejoice When You Die, and that's sort of the bottom line, rejoice.
Did you have any friends or family who had jazz funerals?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. And I understand it. On the way from the church to the gravesite, there is a respect. There's a quiet. But once that body's been released, it's, in other words, buried, then you party.
Now, one of the musicals you're well known for is One More Time, which was meant to be like a revival of a night at the Lyric Theater in 1926. Mm-hmm. And this is what you might have seen on stage there. Mm-hmm. So you do a lot of songs from the 20s, songs I think perhaps that are even earlier.
They're all
from the 20s?
Pretty much the 20s.
Okay. And what are some of the period issues that you had to deal with in doing that show?
Well, I did interviews with people who were still around and had been to that very theater, to the Lyric Theater, and people who had experienced the TOBA circuit.
That's the Theater Owners Booking Association, which was alternately known as Tough on Black Asses.
Yes. And
it was like the vaudeville circuit for African Americans.
Yeah, definitely. Some of the issues that I dealt with was the idea of somebody coming in on a in the colored section of the train, which had to be second only to the cows and the mules, and then getting off the train and not being able to find a hotel because blacks weren't allowed in hotels. And so they had to get to a guest house or something across the tracks where they could stay. And then they come in with this beat-up suitcase, and out of it comes a gown or a suit. And then they hit center stage and become a star. And I think that that's incredible, because part of the whole pumping up of getting to that stage and being there is the treatment that you can receive at the hotel, in the restaurant, whatever. And they got nothing of it, and they were still able to get out there on center stage in a follow spot and hit it and give everything they had. And Bessie Smith could not get into a restaurant, eat afterwards, after a show. And yet that didn't stop them, because they knew they had something to offer. They had talent. They had spirit. They used the performances to say things that were not, that they couldn't say, because there were laws that no more than six blacks could gather in one place at one time without being considered a mob. And so they were, and in church they couldn't say certain things as a community. So they used this space to have social messages, to communicate respect to each other as a unit, to build each other's self-respect. And all those things I try to add in through the structure of vaudeville jokes. How come we always got to stay at a place where hot and cold water means hot in the summer and cold in the winter? You know, they're complaining, but it's not the black defiance as much as it is through the structure of the black vaudeville joke, the way vaudevillians would treat material.
Well, I happen to have the original cast recording queued up.
Oh, okay.
Why don't we hear you singing Cakewalkin' Babies from the original cast recording of One More Time.
Okay.
Introduce the song for us.
Cakewalkin' Babies. It goes back, Cakewalkin' Babies goes back actually to an earlier period of the cakewalk being a number that slaves would use to make fun of the manners of the white owners. And then it became a vaudeville number. This one, by the time it hit the 20s, this is actually just a number.
Okay, so here's the number.
Okay.
Cakewalkin' Babies, sung by my guest, Vernell Bonnaries.
Cakewalkers may come, cakewalkers may go, but I want to tell y'all about this couple I know. They high-stepping gals and debonair. When it comes to business, not a soul can compare.
Here they come.
Well, here they come.
Look at them demonstrate. They go in some.
They go in some.
Look at them sink a big chunk of the town. He's in around, picking them up and laying them down. Dancing fool.
They dancing fool.
That's what they like to call them.
They're in a class of their own. The only way for them to lose is to cheat out. You may try, but you
stretch your stuff.
I'll stretch the stuff.
They don't do nothing different.
The cakewalking babies from
Cakewalkin' Babies from the original cast recording of One More Time, which was written, directed, and starred my guest, Vernell Bonnaries. And sorry for the couple of scratches you heard there. In my defense, I'll say this has not been reissued on CD. So, and it's from the recordings from the early 80s. Vernell Bonnaries is now starring in a new production of the Harold Arlen Johnny Mercer musical, St. Louis Woman, which is being performed now at the Prince Music Theater in Philadelphia.
I must tell you, Terry, that one more time, in its glory right now, you know, it's a hit musical and blah, blah. But we started it on $500 in my living room.
Performing in your living room?
We were rehearsing it in the living room, and the band was in the kitchen. And we opened for one night only in New Orleans on $500 to get together the set and the costumes. And to see that growth is just amazing. We wound up with 7 touring companies of it. And a Royal Command performance for the Queen in London and the West End run. And just amazing what a dream can become.
My guest is Vernell Bonnaries. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Vernell Bonnaries. He's starring in the new revival of the Harold Arlen Johnny Mercer musical, St. Louis Woman. I want to hear a little bit about your life, Vernell. Tell me a little bit about your family. You're from a Creole family?
Yeah, Creole family in New Orleans.
What does that mean exactly?
Creole in New Orleans means part black, French, Spanish, and American Indian. It's sort of a four-part thing. And we had our own culture, in a sense. We had, the writer for the book of St. Louis Woman was a Creole, Honor Bonneton. And he was friends with Jean Toomer, who was a Creole from New Orleans. So there was a lot of literary people that came out of it. They had their own language, Creole French.
You speak it?
No, my father did, but they used it as an adult language.
Oh, kind of like Yiddish and Jewish houses. So the kids don't hear.
The kids don't hear you, right. And that's unfortunate. But certainly people know the food, which to me was sort of everyday cooking, but I'm surprised I'm not 300 pounds.
You're sure not.
But we had a culture with music. With Jelly Roll Martin was a Creole, and it had its own standards.
Tell us something more about your parents and their parents.
My mother's name is Gloria Maria Diaz, and so obviously her side is Spanish-oriented. My father was, until last year, Lawrence Bonnaries, from the French side of it. And they were the values are extremely based in Roman Catholic tradition, and it's extremely family oriented society. Your uncles and your aunts and the idea that everybody sort of pitched together. There was no such thing as you could have and the person down the block didn't. It was a very open, giving sort of environment that I grew up in.
What was your attitude toward different ethnic groups, considering how many ethnic groups were in your family alone?
Well, that was the thing. There were so many ethnic groups that you couldn't have a prejudice. My grandmother, for example, my father's mother, was literally from Toulon, France. She spoke only French. She was white, and my father's father was from Haiti, and so he was part black, and he also spoke French. So they moved into this Creole area, and they felt comfortable there. Everybody I mean, there was no, Creoles were not, they were light-skinned for the most part, but they were not forgiven as far as racial prejudice was concerned. I remember as a child drinking from a colored water fountain, and we always understood that our black blood was first. You weren't excused from anything. You sat in the back of the bus, you did the whole bit. Civil rights time came. I think that a lot of Creoles were foremost politically, as far as getting in lawyers and things like that, getting in and trying to get the laws changed. So we were completely open to white, black. It just didn't matter because they may be your cousin.
Right.
And people chose, sometimes strictly for financial reasons. I remember my aunt, who's still alive in California, she and her sisters would go to work every morning. There was four of them. And three of them would go across the street to a colored cigar rolling factory. As they rolled cigars. And she would go across the street to the white one because she made $2 more an hour. And she thought, well, I'm going to go for the money. But on the way home, they'd all get on the same streetcar and get back home. Huh. And it was a choice you made if you wanted to have that pressure in your life of trying to pass. You went on and did that if it made more financial sense for you. Or if you didn't, you didn't.
Do you have people in your family who passed?
Yeah. And some actually went to the point of sort of distancing themselves from the family. I remember at my grandmother's funeral, my father was furious because his two older brothers came to the funeral, and he'd always thought that they had passed for white and left and never really communicated with the family. But actually, they were products of her first marriage to a white guy, and they were white.
It's confusing, isn't it?
So he had to... He had to refigure once they told him the real story of it, because he just thought that they were brothers who had passed.
That's funny. Well, let me play another recording of yours. And this is actually something you recorded on Fresh Air when you were doing your Jelly Roll Morton show. And in that, it was basically a music review, and you played Jelly Roll Morton.
Yeah.
Morton Gunnar Larson was the pianist. And you not only sang Morton's songs, but you took excerpts of his monologues from the Library of Congress
yes.
recordings and did those monologues as part of the show. So
yeah.
it was really a great piece. Well, so let's hear your recording of Sweet Substitute from the Fresh Air interview that you did in, I think it was 1992. This has Morton Gunnar Larson at the piano.
Sweet substitute. Sweet substitute, she tells me that she's mine, all mine. Does anything I tell her, love is blind. She's got such loving ways, oh ways, got my head in a daze. She's mighty cute, my new recruit, my sweet substitute. Don't want no regulars, my sweet substitute.
Vernell Bonnerice and pianist Morton Gunnar Larson recorded in the Fresh Air Studio in 1992. Now I'm going to let you go in a second because you have a show tonight.
Yeah.
What's it like for you on the day of a performance? Are there things you try to do or try not to do when you know you're going to be on stage?
You lay
that
low,
night? Mm-hmm.
Basically.
Mm-hmm.
And you eat certain things.
Like what?
Well, you eat fruit and vegetables and no spices or bell pepper or things that will let you know you ate them earlier. You just try to keep everything at a smooth level.
Well, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you.
No pepperoni pizza.
Yeah, really.
Great. Thank you, Terry. It was my pleasure.
Bruno Bonaris is currently in Philadelphia, starring in the Prince Music Theater revival of the Arlen Mercer musical St. Louis Woman. It runs through June 25th. Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker on what's happening in teen pop. This is Fresh Air. This is a time when teen pop music rules the charts. The Backstreet Boys, NSYNC, Britney Spears, and Hanson all have current hits in a world that only a few months ago was dominated by more hardcore rap and rock music. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of Britney Spears' Oops, I Did It Again and Hanson's This Time Around. Here's Britney Spears' new interpretation of the Rolling Stones' Satisfaction.
Britney Spears will receive no abuse from me for tackling the Rolling Stones on her new CD. I don't just like her nerve, I like her version. It sure as heck beats the sort of dance music the Stones themselves have tried to pull off over the past couple of decades. If Britney's bubblegum ballads and power pop tunes don't have the harmonic muscle of the best of the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC, Spears makes her little trill of a voice, with its conversational gulps and sighs, work for her.
And get
Rock fans who don't want to admit the pleasures of the new teen acts point to Hanson as the real thing. That is, the fact that these three brothers play their own instruments and write their own songs gives them an authenticity that automatically makes them superior to Britney and the rest. That argument is pre-modernist hooey, of course, and it does little to explain what's really pleasurable about Hanson's music.
It's getting colder in the stitch where I lie. I'm feeling older and I'm wondering why. Well, I heard they told her it was still to live or die. Well, I didn't know her, but I knew why she lied. Well, I didn't know her, but I know why she died.
Three years ago, before the onslaught of current teen pop, Hanson put out a glowing single called Mbop that was a perfect pop song, and followed it up with a solid debut album. Now re-entering a different commercial landscape surrounded by contemporaries who are slicker and more sexually aggressive, Hanson retrenches on its album this time around. If there's no song here as grabby as Mbop, there's still a lot of good fun and good ambition, as on this Latin-tinged rave-up, Can't Stop Thinking About You.
I like the way both Hanson and Britney Spears approach rock history as an open book, as something they can flip through and explore without being intimidated or turned off. Whether it's the Rolling Stones or what my ears hear as Hanson's interest in unexpected influences like 60s groups such as The Blues Project or Blood, Sweat, and Tears, these kids know that music is there to be used, messed with, spruced up, killed, or kissed.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Salad, and Monique Nazareth, with Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, and Megan Howell. Research assistance from Helen Wong. I'm Terry Gross.
I think I did it again. I made you believe we're more than just friends.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Saab, introducing the new performance lineup, the 9.5 Arrow and the 9.3 Viggen. Information available at saabusa.com and 1-800-SAAB-USA. And from eTapestry.com, creator of web-based fundraising software for managing the donor information of large, medium, and small nonprofits. eTapestry.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the creator and executive producer of The Sopranos, David Chase, will talk about how the series has evolved and how it will be affected by the death of Nancy Marchand, who played Tony Soprano's mother. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.